Welcome to Contingency FM. I'm Phil.
Hello, Phil.
Hi.
You haven't planned this very well, have you?
Phil Unplanned White. We're joined today by Jossie Sips Tea at a Desk, Aimer, and Mike the Mike Sen.
Hello.
That is a reference to before we were recording and discussing looking at the mic, and Mike got very self-conscious.
Yeah.
Because we all thought we were looking at you.
Considering this is entirely non-visual.
Yeah. So
I was blushing. Yeah.
We're going to try and avoid any of the references to vision and visual cues from now on. Right. Today we're chatting about IVT, so fluids, fluid balance, and all things fluid.
Before we start, would Mike like to introduce himself?
Yes, that's a great plan. Because I've not
been
even
on
done
the podcast before.
Maybe I should restart this. This is like the worst intro.
I think this works all right. So it's a bit spontaneous and a bit fun, isn't it? That's how radio goes.
I've just done a bad job, guys. Right, anyway, we'll carry on. We'll plow on. Go for it. Who are you? And why are you here?
So I'm Michael Sen. I'm one of the early care registrars. I'm helping out with the teaching team because I've got nothing else better to do at the moment. So I've worked mostly or entirely in the Northeast. Live in Durham. Yeah, that's it generally.
Cool. So thanks so much for joining us today. I realised that my question, who are you and why are you here, was oddly aggressive. But,
it's all right.
we try and make a friendly culture here.
If we'd gone along, you'd have got my PIN number and my mother's name, so that's fine.
But we are very thankful you are here.
Yeah.
Because we're going to talk about IVT,
yeah,
which can be a bit tricky.
So
we appreciate your senior input, or it might be a lot of us saying we would phone the reg
ask
the question.
So we can actually phone the reg and ask the question.
It'll be all right, guys. They're just going to write it down and prescribe it afterwards. I'll tell them what to do, so that'll be all right. Yeah.
So how we're going to approach this is we're going to talk about three cases, which specific cases we've each seen, but they're also representative of other general cases that you might commonly come across. We're going to talk about our approach to them and some of the lessons that we can learn or principles we can learn around IVT and prescribing IVT for these things. So, Mike, you've got our first case. Actually, before that, you've got our first joke.
Yeah, this is a really bad joke. I think we were briefed about bad jokes, actually. We may not have been briefed about bad jokes.
We pride ourselves on badness and jokes.
That's lucky for me. So I am literally a dad, so I do dad jokes. So I have a 3.5-year-old, so I've been trying to teach her the concept of jokes. Because everything she laughs at, she goes, "That's a nice joke." So for the simplest joke I had, which is, "My dog has no nose. How does it smell?" Awful. And the amusing bit is that she constantly keeps on repeating and talks about a dog that smells awful, or this dog without a nose. And I'm starting to think that that concept may be a bit more complicated than I thought.
Yeah, she might start thinking that dogs all don't have noses.
Yeah, I'm trying to work out if a simpler joke may be doable.
I've definitely had jokes that people have done on here that have gone over my head, which have been probably a similar level of complexity. So it might just be, I don't know.
So when I see if you get my one.
Go on, do it.
Why did the scarecrow win an award?
Because I'm trying to think about like Wizard of Oz. Is it something to do with the Wizard of Oz? Why?
No, it was because he was outstanding in his field.
Oh, gosh. Oh dear. That's revolting.
The response is very different, isn't it? Phil has gone, "That's revolting." I've giggled in the corner.
Yeah. Let's move on swiftly. Right, Mike, what's your case?
So mine's just a common thing we see. I often get asked to go to A&E. It's normally A&E, or sometimes arrives to the ward, and it's the patient who's been treated for the sepsis 6. Have you guys done about sepsis 6?
Yeah.
It's perhaps more common since sepsis 6, because obviously it's about fluids in the first hour and things like that. So I saw a patient who, older person, comes in breathless, a little bit hypertensive, a bit of an AKI. And they get given lots of fluid and they get given antibiotics. And this is perhaps less of a problem now because X-ray changes are changing thanks to coronavirus, but I see them and they've got bilateral, they've been diagnosed as having bilateral effusions, and they were diagnosed as having bilateral pneumonia, which before coronavirus was not a common thing. But I think bilateral pneumonitis is a problem here. So I go in and see them, and they've got edematous up to their knees. They've got JVP, which I don't normally look for, but sometimes if I see their edematous and they're puffing away, I've got a history of heart failure, and I see them, and actually they've always had an EKI a bit like that, and they're just hypertensive because they've got really bad heart failure. So actually giving fluids was perhaps not the answer here. So I think this is quite a common thing. Have you guys? I presume you guys have seen it as well. And so I have to go out and work out, what am I going to do next? How do I treat this? And the difficulty here, and this is a common thing you get always asked about, is my patient has low blood pressure.
Mm.
Do I give them fluids? And actually giving fluids here is a bit of a tricky thing here.
And I guess sort of, just very quickly, I guess we're seeing a classical heart failure patient case here. Why have they got low blood pressure? Why is that a common problem?
So without going into too many details, because I'm not a cardiologist, there's a few things. Obviously, the medication we always give. So diuretics cause low blood pressure in dogs. You know, ACE inhibitors. Even GTN obviously can cause. An isoprene can cause low blood pressure. And in severe heart failure, you can get a refractory hypertension because of that. And that can also be associated with things like AF as well. So treating the cardiology problems here, or looking at the drugs, it actually looks at the source of blood pressure rather than fluids here.
So I guess what you're saying is this is actually a really common problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And the cardiologists hate sepsis 6 because everyone gets fluids, and then you have to dial it back and work out what you're going to do now. And that's quite a tricky thing, which is why I brought it, because it's something that makes you think, oh, maybe fluids isn't the answer. Which is the odd choice for a first talk in a fluids talk. But
Well, I think it's important. I think it's the first question we should be asking when we approach a patient is do they need fluids?
Yeah, absolutely.
So what's your approach when you approach this patient?
So I think I always go, and I think it's always useful to see the patient if you haven't seen them before. Eyeball them, and you can always do an A to E assessment. And in particular, you're going to assess, you're going to go through their skin turgor, looking if they're dry, but also looking for edema as well, because that might be sign they're overfilled. Literally, some patients are underfilled and overfilled, and then we talk about that in a bit. And then also going through their cardiovascular history as well, looking at oxygen they're needing. And then obviously, because we've got access to systems here in the notes, we can go through the notes and look at their past medical history, look at any echoes, and going through their medication as well. And those are all good clues to see what's going on, actually. And actually going through those, talk to the patient, and they say, oh, I get a bit more breathless, lying flat at night, or I sleep with four pillows, that's probably a sign that they might be struggling in the past.
So I guess what you're saying then is that, and your initial approach of asking yourself, does someone need fluids in the first place? It's seeing the whole patient as a whole, with all, not just looking at their blood pressure, but looking at all the different factors,
absolutely,
the history, everything that. And then you're then, so that,
it's not simply a case, and it's really easy, especially on computer-based systems, such we have at Sunderland here, to prescribe fluids when you've been asked to do it. But actually assessing the patient first is the really important thing, to make sure that things are done in the right way and the patient is getting the treatment that they needed, rather than just treating the numbers, as you said.
And what about if you thought that you had a patient with kind of a similar history of heart failure, they had signs of peripheral edema, but you also thought they were septic, say they had a chest sepsis and you did want to give fluids. How do you then approach that?
That's really tricky, actually. And these are the ones I sometimes, especially if they're really unwell, like they're severely hypotensive. And I think it's this horrible combination where they're dry and they're edematous. So their mouth is dry, they're not weeing, and they've also got peripheral edema, and they've got like pleural effusions. Sorry, I'm just pointing to my chest there, guys. This is a very non-visual podcast, as I mentioned before. These are the guys I would often discuss and escalate to. We have outreach here at Sunderland. I'm not entirely sure what's at South Tyneside, but I presume there's a similar thing, and there'll be a similar thing regionally, because actually finding out and deciding a ceiling of care for these patients is important, because you have to make a decision eventually whether you're going to give fluids or stop medication, and you're going to have to make that decision early.
And what might tip you towards giving fluids, and what might tip you towards holding off?
So I think giving fluids is if they've got signs of renal disease, so particularly like if they've got hyperkalemia with, and they're not weeing, that might be giving it a sign that I might give fluids.
Okay. Urine output's quite a big marker, isn't it?
Absolutely, and I think I'm a big fan of catheterizing patients, or rather asking people to be catheterized. As again, it's a privilege of the position I'm in, but but if you can get a fluid balance, that's a really useful way to see what's going on. If they're not weeing, then you're going to have to probably give some fluids, because giving more diuretics isn't going to improve the urine output. And then the other thing that might tip you in is you know, again, we're talking about very high severe AKI, so very right high potassium, metabolic acidosis, that's very low bicarbonates. These are the ones that you might consider giving fluids. But for those ones, again, if they're appropriate, you're probably discussing with an outreach, or if you're junior, you can discuss with a senior colleague and they can assess and go through there.
I suppose the concern with giving someone with severe heart failure fluids is that you give them kind of pulmonary edema and then they can't saturate,
absolutely,
in the sats drop. So would you be guided by kind of the oxygenation as well in the chest x-ray?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think, you know, you try and do things, and often this is just putting a finger in the dam rather than doing anything, but things like removing all the medications apart from, say, the diuretics and the critical medications, so that they don't need the amlodipine when they're in crushing heart failure and sepsis. Absolutely, pulmonary edema with sepsis is a bad combination, actually, and it's definitely something that you need to think about and how you do it, because giving fluids may make it significantly worse. And you have to be really strong. You often get asked a lot of questions by the teams. This patient's got really low pressure, they're not weeing, can I give fluids? And you have to really be cautious and really reassess these patients all the time.
Something which I find quite helpful, like as like a rule by thumb, I hope I'm doing it right. You can tell me if I've been treating people terribly for the last 4 years, but is looking at things from an ABCDE point of view. So the reason why ABCDE is done in that order is because that's the order that things kill you. So if your airway's gone, that's going to kill you a lot quicker than if you're struggling breathing, it's going to kill you a lot quicker if you've got a problem with circulation. So if someone hasn't got pulmonary edema, then but they've got crashing blood pressure, then they've got a circulatory problem. So I can put fluids in, but then if they have, then I might want to preserve the lungs.
One of the renal consultants here said to me that it's no point dying of beautiful kidneys. So you have to treat things that are in front of you. So yeah, absolutely, oxygen, assessing airways, making sure, because that's going to be the thing that's going to send them to higher escalation, so ITU, things like that, HDU. That's going to cause more problems, so therefore, treating that rather than worrying about other things.
Quick question, what's your thoughts, both of you, on giving furosemide with fluid? Because I guess sort of if someone's got both crashing blood pressure and pulmonary edema, then you might think, I can give furosemide to get rid of the pulmonary edema, but then can I then treat that crashing blood pressure with fluids? So what do you think?
Doesn't make much sense to me. I've never done it apart from when that fluid has been blood.
Mm-hmm.
So you're giving them red blood cells and you're removing the fluid, but I've never given IVT, saline or Hartmann's, and furosemide. To me, they just cancel each other out.
No, that makes sense to me. And it's something I've seen before. And again, if you're getting to the point where you think you need to give fluids and they've got pulmonary edema, it's actually you get to the point you have severe AKI or renal failure and you've got severe hypertension and pulmonary edema, that's getting to the point where actually dialysis might become a thing.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, giving furosemide may be a... a stopgap, giving fluids as well as furosemide, as Justin said, it is perhaps a bit contradictory in itself. Yeah. It's very difficult. Mm. I certainly wouldn't stop people drinking water if they can drink water, because that's just not unpleasant. But I think, I don't know, I'm struggling to think of a case where I've done that recently.
The only situations I can think of where it's actually relevant, because I guess like the reason why you do that is because it's when you've got something in the fluid that you're giving that you want, but you don't want the fluid itself.
Yeah,
so like in
so.
Blood, you want the red blood cells, but you don't want the fluid in the blood. And I guess the only other situation I can think of like that is if you've got someone with severe hyponatremia and you're giving a hypertonic saline, mm-hmm. You want the salt, but you don't want the fluid. If someone's like, let's say that they've got it because of massive heart failure.
Yeah.
So in my head, that would make sense to give furosemide and hypertonic saline if you wanted to just keep it.
So in hyponatremia, if you're overloaded, the hyponatremia could be caused by the overload.
Yeah.
So that's an assessment of that. I think your point is reasonable, because if you've got hypokalemia, and that's certainly a problem in patients you're giving lots of diuretics to, you might want to give potassium to, because that's an issue. Normally below 3, I wouldn't give, I wouldn't rely only on Sando-K or KCL or something like that. So you'd want to give IV potassium. Again, this might be one of those situations where you want to discuss with HCU, because they can give stronger concentrations, so therefore then give higher volumes of potassium in small amounts of fluids.
Mm.
So we can only normally give about 40 millimoles in a bag, whereas I think they can give more, have to admit. It's not something I've routinely come across. You can try and get around it with spironolactone or something like that. It's like a potassium sparing diuretic. But yeah, electrolytes are difficult to get around with. I think blood is certainly a situation where you give diuretics. I'm trying to let some of the patients you do sometimes as well give albumin and furosemide too, but they're only the patients who have severe ascites.
And it's tricky and it's a difficult decision, and it's certainly not anything you should be deciding as an F1.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's a take home, isn't it? All these situations we're talking about here, apart from the blood one, are things where you would be discussing with quite senior people in hospital. Yeah.
These are not black and white situations. You can tell that we're having to think about this, and if that's a case that we're doing it, then you should be doing it at a junior level, definitely.
So I guess the first question then, do they need fluids? The second question is, what kind of fluids to give, or what route to give? Jossie, you've got a good story about this. That's a nice segue, isn't it?
So when we were thinking about kind of cases to kind of have a chat about, we were thinking about things where we'd perhaps not made the best decisions, because obviously those are the best things to reflect on, and to try and stop you guys from kind of making the same mistakes as we did. So in Foundation, I saw a elderly gentleman who had an AKI that had gone unnoticed. It had been deteriorating over the kind of last week or so, but no one had really picked up on it.
Yeah.
It wasn't documented anywhere in the notes, and nothing had been done. And I tried many times to get a cannula in and failed.
Mm.
And so put him on subcut fluids overnight. Mm. And the next morning, kind of the consultant said, probably wasn't the best idea. You know, I can completely understand why you did it, because you couldn't get access, so it's logical, but actually kind of subcut fluid isn't going to make any difference to kind of his kidney function.
Why is that?
So as I understand it, subcut fluid, because you can only give it 12 hourly, that's the quickest you can put it through, and because you're not putting it intravascularly, it just gets kind of absorbed slowly. You can't get enough in to make a difference. So you can maintain someone's hydration. But once someone has developed an AKI, it's not sufficient
volume. You need to straight into the intravascular space.
Yeah. To make a difference.
Mm. So what circumstances would you use subcut fluids?
So I think, well, in my experience, it's most often used on kind of care of the elderly wards, and it was used a little bit on my palliative care job as well, as a way of keeping patients hydrated when they couldn't manage the oral intake themselves, either because they have a delirium or a dementia that prevents them from managing their oral intake, or if they're too unwell, too sleepy, or on palliative care sometimes if they were vomiting or nauseous. And it's just a nicer way, really, of giving fluids if you don't need the IV access. It's just a tiny little needle that goes just under the skin. So it's just...
It doesn't bother people, does it?
No, not at all. And it's not as irritating. They can put it in patients' backs and they don't really notice it. It's not nearly as irritating as having a cannula attached to your arm.
And, look, I mean, that's that situation with people who, for whatever reason, you can't get a cannula in, or it's not appropriate to put cannula in. It is a common one, especially, as you say, in elderly care. Apart from subcut fluids, if you need to get someone's hydration in, what other ways can you do that?
So I did a job on stroke, so a lot of the patients had unsafe swallows, so a lot of them had NG tubes, so they'd have kind of NG feed, and some of them would have kind of NG water put through in addition to the feed if the dietitians felt that that was kind of needed. They work all that out for you kindly and tell you what to prescribe.
And then, Mike, you mentioned even just getting people to drink is not inappropriate.
Yeah, it's kind of a rite of passage for geriatricians that we all will one day give a patient a drink, normally with spending 10 minutes with them to try and do it. And squash makes a difference as well. Apparently Diet Coke with thickener is apparently quite nice. Yeah, I struggle to believe it. If
yeah, because thickener in water, I can't. It just looks like mucus.
It's when you see this, like if you have a, I think it's 3 scoops, it might be 4 scoops now because they've changed the thickness slightly, and the spoon stands up to it. And that's I don't know how anyone would manage it.
This is a completely irrelevant aside, but I do like putting these in from time to time. Have you ever noticed that water tastes like its temperature?
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
So I wonder what, like, I guess it just, like, it'd be just lukewarm mush.
Tried it before, I think it's really grainy.
The hint of grain.
It's everyone knows what water's supposed to be like.
Would you like a glass of lukewarm mush with a bit of grain? That would get you.
Apparently with Diet Coke it tastes a bit like fizzy, but like not fizzy cola bottles, like cola bottles. Apparently it's a bit more palatable.
Oh, definitely, yeah. That sounds much better.
Yeah, you can try, I guess the other thing, I mean, difficult cannulas, I think we were talking about, but escalation as well. And that's a difficult thing, perhaps, in your early things. I remember being absolutely petrified of trying to ring my registrar. That's just me being a nervous F1. I own needles, intraosseous needles, again, but that's probably unconscious, really, really, really poorly patients.
Yes.
As well.
Or really, really sick kids.
Really, really sick kids. Oh, are they? Oh, right, okay.
As well, yeah, you can do that as well, but that's unusual.
Is that any humerus, is it, instead of the tibia?
Yeah, okay.
And I have done it once, and it is exactly like a drill. It's very odd.
Yeah.
But it does work. But no, I think you're absolutely right. We do give subcut fluids on elderly care wards. Unfortunately, they don't get perturbed by the needles. They get perturbed by the drip lines, so they will pull the lines out.
Yeah,
and so, I mean, sometimes it is very appropriate, but sometimes when we just keep giving it can become inappropriate. I think if someone isn't going to manage oral intake because of a irreversible condition that they have, at some point they're going to go home and they're still not going to be managing. Have to ask yourself what you're achieving.
I think it's a good goal if you have someone who's not drinking is to work out what the goal is, what the cause is. In dementia patients, severe dementia patients, they often lose their thirst, so giving fluids doesn't solve the loss of thirst, and therefore giving fluids is treatment, and it prolongs life rather than necessarily helping with suffering.
Yeah.
And again, with NG tubes, if you've got someone who's stroke patients, is likely to recover, more likely to be recovered.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of dementia patients also lose their swallow, so therefore giving an NG tube may not be appropriate. In fact, there's national guidelines on that as well, actually.
Yeah. So you're sort of recognising someone's quality of life.
Yeah, and the difficulty is if you start with these treatments, start with fluids or start... NG tubes, you'll have seen it in palliative care especially, it's very emotive to stop these, so people don't like, because they think that you're
killing them.
Yeah, because stopping fluids is a very emotive topic.
When this comes up, or when it will come up as F1s, is you're asked to prescribe fluids overnight. You know, oh, this lady's subcut fluids, IV fluids are just running out. Do you want some more, doctor? And it's a patient you've not met before, and you know, there might be a clear reason. You might be able to very clearly kind of say yes or no. But a lot of the time, I think it's just kind of people have prescribed maintenance fluid, but not put in a clear plan.
Yeah, absolutely.
Delay, like kicking a decision down the road.
Yeah, and we're not. I don't think anyone would expect you to make any of these really difficult decisions overnight. But it might be a case of, you know, having a look through and putting a little comment in the notes saying, you know what, this is the decision I've made overnight, but I wonder if ongoing fluids is appropriate for this patient. Can the day team review that?
Yeah, you have to be careful. Obviously, don't write anything too bossy, but things like day team to review would be a reasonable thing to write, but day team haven't done this is probably not the best thing to write.
No.
Unfortunately, I have seen that. Not.
Yeah. No, I mean, ask the question.
Attitude doesn't go down too well.
Yeah.
No attitude, but no ask attitude. The question.
I think that's totally reasonable.
Yeah.
And actually, you can always assess, and if they're not drinking, but their blood pressure's fine, and they're not dehydrated, and actually they might be okay without it.
Mm. So I guess we've chatted there about, does the patient need fluids? What kind of fluids to give / what route? I don't know if anyone wants to sort of just briefly mention differences between sodium chloride, Hartmann's, and glucose. Briefly, sort of, where would you give each of those and why?
This might be my fault because I think I sent him a graph. The potted answer is that sodium chloride has too much sodium and chloride in it. So if you give lots of it, they can get hypernatremic and hyperchloremic.
Yep.
And you might have seen this in DKA patients because they get hypochloremic acidosis. Mm. Dextrose doesn't have any sodium or chloride in it, so therefore that it can cause the other problems and go low, and is also not great for hypertensive patients.
Yeah. It's not that bad for diabetes though, in terms of like there's so little sugar in it. That
5% is absolutely fine.
Don't worry about giving that in diabetics. Yeah.
5%, which is the one we normally give, is absolutely fine. Yeah, and the other one you might see is dextrose saline, which is 4%.
Mm.
So that's absolutely fine as well. Yeah, it shouldn't cause hypers. Hartmann's is thought to be a bit better, but it's not perfect. And the other one is dextrose saline, which we don't really have at Sunderland. And you can put potassium in it. But
my comment on this would be that consider whether you're giving maintenance fluids or long-term fluids, or if you're giving acute fluids. Because if you're giving acute fluids, I would give sodium chloride for two reasons. First, it stays in the veins better. And second is that it doesn't contain any potassium, and so you can give it as fast as you want.
Yeah, that's a reasonable thing to give. Hartmann's is not too bad, but you're right, the potassium is a problem sometimes. Mm. If you're giving regular fluids, then probably you probably give electrolytes with it, which is probably, again, another problem with subcut fluids, because you can't put potassium in subcut fluids normally.
You can also only give sodium chloride subcut, is that correct?
So some places you can give dextrose, I'm not quite sure about here.
You can't give Hartmann's subcut.
You can't give Hartmann's subcut, and you can't put additional potassium. So therefore, in patients who are hypokalemic, you should give it in some other
way. So I guess what we're saying is that Hartmann's is probably, of all of them, Hartmann's or dextrosaline is probably your ideal one.
Yeah.
However, they don't get used either because dextrosaline is actually quite unusual or hard to get hold of, and because there's certain situations where Hartmann's shouldn't be given, whether it's subcut or in acute bonuses.
Absolutely right. I think, as you said, normal 0.9% saline is a reasonable resuscitation fluid, absolutely.
So come on to our final question that I think is important to ask when you're coming along to decide about fluids, is it's kind of two questions, actually. It's a bit of a cheat, but it is how much and how fast? I did have a story, but I realise now that it's irrelevant to this question. And also, we've already discussed the sort of my learning point from it. So I'm going to ignore that and just... So it's kind of coming back to what you said at the beginning, Mike, is sort of, I think you need to work out what someone's fluid status is, and you'd said that by basically looking at the whole patient. And it's asking, okay, do they need sort of a litre? Are they litres deficient? Do they need litres? Or is it only small amounts? And then how fast can we give that? So I guess, like, what's their ability to cope with that new fluid? So have they got heart failure? How are the kidneys working?
Mm.
Is there anything you'd add to how you'd approach in that situation? Just your mic.
I think if I'm giving stat fluids, like for the really unwell patients, these are the patients I hang around with and watch the fluids go in, because you can sometimes give them through a pressure bag. You might have seen it. It's like a blood pressure cuff. So you basically inflate it and then you put water fluid through. And I think that's quite a good thing to see, and then recheck the blood pressure afterwards. But
if you don't have one, you can squeeze the bag.
You can squeeze the bag, and that's normally someone's job at a cardiac arrest, to be honest.
I think sometimes people err on the side of caution a little much when we're doing acute resuscitation. And we, you know, we're taught very rightly to be careful and to not overload people. And therefore, I see people prescribing and asking the nursing staff to get 250 mils and 500 mils. And if someone is really acutely unwell and hypotensive, then you can put a litre up and you can stop it after 500 mils if 500 is enough. But it is then there, and you don't have to send the nursing staff off kind of four times
That's
to get
really
two
point,
250
yeah,
bags.
Yeah, I think especially because if you think like in a septic patient, especially someone young, so like under 60, that's a nice definition of young, isn't it? So someone young, under 60, the reason why the blood pressure is low, heart rate is high, is because in sepsis your veins come very, very leaky, and so all that fluid moves out into the interstitial fluid, and you can lose litres there. And so someone can quite happily take 500 to a litre in one go. I mean, if you're on a hot sunny day, you might drink a litre in one go.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, fluid is, despite what we're saying about the pitfalls, it's quite a good treatment to give in most cases.
Yeah.
I think if I'm seeing a poorly patient, I'm thinking about doing bloods, I put on a cannula in, because then coming back to Joseph's point about getting things efficient, then you've got a cannula in, so that if you need to give fluids, you can do it straight away.
Yeah. That said, I guess it comes back to, and it's a nice sort of circle back around again, to that first type of patient you described of sort of someone with high heart, like extreme heart failure, is that when you've got a patient who might not tolerate fast fluid, then you have got to be very careful, and you've got to maybe stay with them, observe them, but take it cautiously in those sort of patients. But I guess it's taking everything into account and making a judgment decision, which I think is what makes IVT sometimes more complicated than it might seem on the surface.
Yeah. And over time, people get more confident about things. You know, you have more awareness of things, and these decisions that we're talking about, like an 80/80 assessment, you can almost start and complete it within, you know, a few minutes, and actually as that comes on, you get more confidence in it.
Yeah.
And I think people do a lot of fluid prescribing by themselves, and it's not really something you do in a team, because you're just asked to do it, and it's okay to ask for feedback on that. I know it seems simple, but if you're not sure what would be the best thing to do, then ask someone.
Yeah.
If you prescribe fluid overnight, then go back and see what the day team did. Follow up on these things so that you learn from what you're doing.
As a med reg, if you had a F1 in the first month of starting and they were asking you for advice overnight about fluid or just to check that, would you be alright with that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that's not a uncommon call at all.
Yeah.
And, you know, if I'm worried, at all worried,
yeah,
and you say to me, can you come and say hello? I'll come and say hello to the patient as well. So by all means, all of us would be happy to answer questions about fluids. There's also the SHOs around. Obviously, different specialties are different tiers. But yeah, if you rang up the MedReg first, I'd be more than happy to help.
Yeah.
And all my colleagues would be as well.
Yeah. Cool. So we've got Song of the Week.
So I had Monday off because I worked the weekend, and I came back on Tuesday, and all of the teaching fellows were completely obsessed. In the space of one day with the Iceland Eurovision entry, the Think
oh,
About Things.
Phenomenal. And the video is absolutely hilarious. We've got the dance mastered now.
Yes.
Well, I say mastered. They tell me I'm all limbs. But do go and check that out, the Icelandic entry, Think About Things. It is brilliant. That is all from us. This has been Contingency FM.